on the screen to sort of indicate that you are looking to ask a question. And then once Aaron is through, Mara will sort of announce your name, unmute you, and then you are able to ask of Aaron your question or your concern. And then I do want to take this opportunity also to introduce Mara a little. She is actually our new executive director for McHenry and Kane County. Many of us have not necessarily seen her or met her yet, but she is with us now in place of Sue, so that if you do have any questions, certainly do look to reach out to her. And without sort of further time delay, I will let Aaron go ahead and get started. And then at the end, we will take questions and unmute, announce the person and unmute them at that time.
Great. Thank you so much for the introduction. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Aaron O'Brien, and I have been lobbying for ISMS for 16 years. I work with a team. I have two other lobbyists who live and are based in Springfield. We work very closely with the entire ISMS staff, mostly, most important, David Porter's health policy staff, along with communications. And for those, so for those of you who don't know you, you really have a village working for you and a committed team. And I'm happy to take questions on some of the internal processes when we get to the end, but I do need to give credit where credit is due, and it is really to the entire ISMS staff. My presentation really here today is to kind of brief you on what we thought 2020 was gonna look like as far as legislative agenda, what our priority was or and continues to be, along with, you know, some obstacles and some what I always refer to as bad bills that we faced. I also kind of want to run through with you what happened when the pandemic hit, the shelter at home was issued, and our legislative session came to a halt, and how we worked with the administration on securing some important executive orders. And I know there's some frustration with the governor's office, and I'm happy to take questions on that. But we really did communicate with his staff almost every day, trying to advocate for physicians. I also kind of want to run through with you what we expect in 2021, which I have to say we all have to take with a grain of salt, because no one really knows what's going to happen next year. The best I can do is make an educated guess based on what other legislators tell me and what the leaders are telling us. But just so you're kind of aware on what the legislative, what legislators are thinking. I do focus on state government. We don't do any federal government. We do work with the AMA on federal issues. That being said, we do have personal relationships with many of our Illinois congressional delegation. And we do reach out to them when necessary, but we try not to interfere too much with the AMA's work on those issues. Mara, do you want to, let me see if we can get the PowerPoint up.
Okay, let me make you host and then you can share your screen.
And you'll have to forgive us. We're all working a little new on this. If you could, let me get this up here. Okay, Mara, you'll just have to remind me. Oh, there we go.
You have the share screen.
Yeah. So can everybody see this, I hope? I know you're all muted. So, Dr. King,
yes.
Okay,
can you see this? I see you have it up.
Great. We're just gonna kind of flip through. When session started, our priority was really to reform the prior authorization processes utilized by our state regulated payers. And this includes both our Medicaid MCOs and our commercial private plans. This does not unfortunately apply to ERISA plans. They are federally regulated, but we felt it important to start somewhere. The need for change was apparent through a 2019 survey we sent out. I think 98% of respondents sent their survey back in and really had some significant complaints about the obstacles that insurance companies are putting up through prior authorization. And I know I don't need to tell you of the problem, although I am very interested in hearing some of your stories. And I mentioned this campaign we created. We really created a coalition of advocates that have been seeking change. And if you visit yourcarecan'twait.com, you'll see that we're joined by the hospitals, by nurses, by other healthcare professionals, and by patient groups. And on that website, what we really ask for is if you have stories to share about how prior authorization has hindered your ability to deliver care, share those stories. Because when we go to the legislature, those are the stories that really bring their support home. A couple of just, I won't read these word for word, but we introduced a comprehensive bill based on the complaints we received in the survey. It's a big, big bill, but our goals were to create transparency. And by transparency, what we want to do is force insurance companies to communicate consistently what services are they requiring. And I think it's important to note that our bill doesn't seek to just focus on the prescription of drugs or delivery of a certain service. We're really here to get at the process in general and apply it to both. And apply it to all patients, whether it's preventative care, chronic care, or acute care. So we want to force insurance companies to be transparent on what they're requiring of prior authorization. When are they making changes to the process? Because a lot of the complaints we got were questions from physicians. We don't even know what's required of prior authorization. Last month, this wasn't required a prior authorization, and now the service I'm requesting is. So there is clearly a lot of frustration there. One issue we are trying to get at, too, in regards to transparency, is getting at the issue of how many denials do you make? What's the time submission between when the request is sent in and when the physician is responded to? How many appeals are successful? Because one thing we heard in the survey was a lot of physicians have the experience of, well, the service is denied, then I appeal it, and then it's accepted. We do fear that insurance companies are routinely denying care, knowing that it will be approved on appeal, but it's their attempt to further delay care. What we do in our bill is to make sure there's an appropriate peer-to-peer review process. We did hear a lot of frustration from physicians that they're often transferred to either a physician who's not, doesn't practice in that specialty or isn't familiar with that specialty, or many physicians said they were transferred to a pharmacist or an advanced practice nurse, and they just didn't feel that the decision to either to deny was clearly the medical necessity was not being understood by the professional reviewing the case. We also want to make sure, and this is a story we got from our chairman who had requested a surgery. The surgery was denied, and he complained that, well, this is what says should happen according to these surgical standards and these guidelines, and the insurance company shot back and said, well, we have our own guidelines, and didn't share those guidelines. So that also gets to the transparency of the issue. It's still surprising to me, but we still get so many complaints from surgeons who call and say, I'm about to go into surgery, but the prior authorization on the anesthesia hasn't been approved yet. In our humble opinion, if the surgery is approved, the anesthesia should be approved. It's the same service. You can't do one without the other. And so this is what this first bullet point in this next slide is really trying to get at. And I'm sure as physicians, you may have other stories about instances where you want to provide a treatment plan, but only half of the treatment plan was approved, and the other treatment plan that you're still waiting for or was either denied. So this is what we really want to get at here. The second bullet point, I apologize, I think I wasn't typing as fast as I was thinking. For patients, especially nowadays with so many people losing their job or transitioning to a job, those patients who suffer from chronic conditions, if they're on a treatment plan that has been approved, we want to provide some sort of continuity that treatment is going to continue to exist if and when they have to change insurance plans. And we provide a 90-day period for that. So, and this is really, and again, well, the whole point of this bill is to help patients get the treatment that they need. And we want physicians determining that treatment and obviously not the insurance companies. And then, you know, finally, you should get paid for services that are approved. We've heard too many complaints that the approval will come through, but the payment won't. So this is an important point to us. You know, at the beginning of 2000, or beginning of this year in January, we really did gain a lot of momentum in the legislature for this. You know, this is something that I think affects most patients, and a lot of legislators have heard about this problem. And if we were to look up the bill, House Bill 5510, it has strong bipartisan support, and we were actually poised to pass it out of the House committee and pass it out of the House right before the pandemic hit and government shut down. So this will be a priority for us in 2021. Fingers crossed that there's some sort of session during 2021. But there is a lot of support for this among the legislature. There's a lot of support for it because physicians have reached out and shared their stories. And again, I would encourage all of you who are frustrated by these processes to reach out to ISMS, either to me, you can go on the ISMS.org, you can see the link there. But this is really what drives it home for legislature. Our legislature is changing. It used to be, you know, it started pretty Republican, and now it's moved into the more moderate, reasonable, you know, like, I don't know, moderate, but a lot of it's becoming much more progressive, for good or bad. But the legislature, the insurance lobby is losing a lot of support that it previously had. And I think this is a good opportunity for physicians who are frustrated by the process to change it. And that's really what we're trying to take advantage of here. Unfortunately, though, it's not all rainbows and unicorns. There's always bills introduced that we oppose. We probably spend 80% of our time opposing bad bills. A lot of them are mandates. We see these every year in various forms on various issues. You know, this last year, we saw a lot of, and we continue to see a lot of mandates when it comes to prescribing opioids and how physicians communicate with their patients and how many pills a physician can prescribe. You know, we've been successful in beating all of those back, but they are introduced every year. The three main ones this year was one we've seen every year for the last 4 years, and that would be limiting a physician's prescription to 7 pills for a Schedule II opioid. The second one, which I find particularly offensive, is a mandate on a physician to co-prescribe naloxone in certain circumstances and then have a conversation with the patient and a patient's designee on the risk of addiction. I find this particularly offensive because the advocate behind the bill is a company that makes naloxone. This is a blatant grab to increase their profits. Fortunately, we have been able to beat this bill back, but it's just frustrating to have this conversation over and over again. In 2020, it was introduced by Senator Melinda Bush. I don't know if anybody's from Lake County on this call, but you know, it's just a frustrating conversation to have. And we expect it to be introduced next year as well. The third one, again, relates to opioids and the prescription of minors. And again, it's just mandating a conversation that the physician has to have with the minor and the minor's parent. And our argument always is, it's not appropriate for the legislature to interfere what happens in the office. Physicians know what they're doing. And they're gonna do what's in the best interest of the patient. And in my humble opinion, when you try to force one conversation, you're prohibiting the physician from having another conversation, which is probably more important. And those arguments resonate, but you know, this is something that we have to struggle with every year. And then the second bullet point, again, these are regular fights we have. Everybody wants to be a doctor. No one wants to go to medical school. This year, we saw two bills introduced by physician assistants for independent practice. Psychologists want to come back and have unfettered prescriptive authority. Dentists want to provide vaccines across the board. Pharmacists are definitely coming back with a bill to expand their scope. They want to be considered primary care providers. They compare themselves to physician assistants and APRNs. We don't agree with that. We don't like the blurring of the lines, if you will. But those are, you know, there's always those bills. And we're fairly successful in beating those back. You know, scope is a little hard and they always have their supporters, but generally the General Assembly agrees with us. You know, education and training is kind of key to patient safety. And I know I don't need to tell you that, but legislators don't always understand it. So these are some of the obstacles that we face. You know, they tout access to healthcare. Our answer back, which I'm gonna get into a little bit later, is telehealth. You don't rob the patient of important safety protections. So we'll talk about telehealth in a little bit. And then there are always bills introduced by the trial lawyers. They typically introduce one or two big bills a year. We haven't had an issue with them up until 2020. They did introduce a bill that we are very opposed to that would make it easier for the plaintiff to venue shop and make it harder for the defendant to push back on their choice of venue. This is where I'm glad Sessions shut down. We are in a Democratic state. While we do have great relationships with members on both sides of the aisle, sometimes it can be a little tough to beat them back. I don't know that it will be introduced in 2021. I do expect a bill to be introduced, so we will see. But we have been consistently communicating our opposition to members of both sides of the aisle. And I'm happy to report a lot of Democrats on the House Judiciary think it's a bad idea too. So it's kind of a wait. We just have to wait and see what happens in 2021. Let's see if I can. So as I stated, you know, the shelter at home issue, I think was issued March 13th, March 14th. That shut government down. Without any indication on when it may reconvene. It was kind of a wait and see approach. But we knew based on other states that we had to start reaching out to the administration to get some important executive orders. It's all new for us. We've never worked under this kind of scenario before. I would say that the two priorities for us, which we were successful in getting, was an executive order that forced insurance companies, both public and private, so both the MCOs and the commercial health insurance companies, to cover or offer unrestricted telehealth. And by what I mean unrestricted telehealth is not only coverage, parity, but payment parity as well. There have been many discussions for years on how to pass telehealth policy on the state level, and it really comes down to payment parity. Insurance companies argue that telehealth was created to cut down costs. I would argue that that might be, but telehealth was created to expand access to care. And if you're going to cut costs, you can't do it at the physician's expense. It also allows for a lot of flexibility. The executive order allows for a lot of flexibility in the originating and distant site, which is important, I think, during COVID, as we all know. So you can minimize your time away from the office. So patients, particularly those with chronic conditions, don't have to leave their house. And there was flexibility on how physicians and patients, as you know, could communicate, whether it be FaceTime, landline phones, cell phones, and all of that is reimbursable. We believe that this telehealth executive order will continue to be extended until we go to level 5, which I'll get into in a minute. But I believe that we will be working under this executive order well into 2021, which is a good thing. And then our other priority, which we started reaching out right away, was we need to get immunity for protection from civil lawsuits, because we knew elective surgeries and services were going to be reduced. And then that could increase adverse outcomes. And that was to no fault of the physician. And so we were successful in securing the first one, Executive Order 19, which provided for blatant and broad immunity. So you, during the first couple months of this COVID, when everything shut down, a physician cannot be sued for an adverse outcome due because of COVID. And then the governor came back after things started relaxing a little bit, issued a new executive order on immunity that narrowed it a little bit after elective procedures were allowed to now continue, but did provide immunity for professionals working in facilities that did have COVID patients in it. So those were two important EOs that we secured. We also reached out to the Illinois Department on Public Health on a variety of issues, but we knew there was gonna be a reduction or a prohibition, I hate to use that word, on elective procedures. And we were watching what happened in other states. And in other states, that prohibition, we call the guidance here, but there was a really strict prohibition, and it didn't allow for any professional judgment. So what we were able to secure in the guidance put out by IDPH was some professional judgment by the physician to determine what is medically necessary and what is elective. It was difficult to secure. It was important to secure. I'm glad that the restriction is now lifted. I'm hoping we don't go back to any sort of shelter at home or restriction, but we have to wait and see. And then finally, the Illinois Department of Financial and Professional Regulation deals with everything scope related. So they're the ones getting hammered by pharmacists, by psychologists, by physician assistants who asked for the world. And we worked very, very well with the secretary of that department. And her position is demonstrate to me the education and training you get to be able to do the work of a physician, which they can't do because they don't have. So we were able to shut down all of those requests by working with the department. So we were pretty pleased about that. You know, the legislature did return in mid-May because we needed a budget. They did pass a $39.9 billion budget that included a lot for healthcare. They also passed a hospital assessment or approved the hospital assessment program, which did include $150 million increase for physician reimbursement under Medicaid. In the grand scheme of things, it might not seem like a lot of money, but it's the first increase across the board increase we've had since really the inception of Medicaid. We don't know how the details are really going to work out. For those of you who know Ken Ryan, our Medicaid expert at ISMS, he's working with the department every day on this. The legislature House Majority Leader Greg Harris, you know, when he was talking about this, he acknowledged that it's not enough. We need to pay our physicians more, but we have to start somewhere. And our budget is in dire, dire straits. So I'm pretty pleased that we got something and we'll continue to advocate for more. There was a huge debate on telehealth during this crazy 4-day special session. The insurance, so we had a bill ready to go that would codify the executive order. It passed out of the House. The insurance companies got a hold of it in the Senate and convinced the chairman of the Senate insurance company to put that aside and focus on language that would allow them to determine the reimbursement rate paid to physicians. We shut this down. Insurance companies are very, very scared about where telehealth is going to go because they know the longer we work under the executive order, the harder it is for them to going to be able to reduce anything moving forward. So they're very anxious to start negotiations on this issue. ISMS, along with IHA and some other healthcare advocates, kind of want to wait and see and continue to work under the executive order as long as we can, knowing it's going to be harder for the insurance companies in the long run. So that's kind of where we're at now on that. You know, what happens next is like the million-dollar question. I think we're going to be in phase four for a very long time. The governor did, as you know, change the regions. We're working on a regional approach now. And I think, you know, I'm hoping that no region goes back into a shutdown. I know the Metro East area outside of St. Louis is in a lot of trouble. I know Peoria's in a lot of trouble. Their numbers are not looking so great. But I think we're going to be able to avoid a statewide shutdown. We won't move to stage five until there's a vaccine and it's widely distributed. So I don't know when that will be. And you probably know much more than I do on that. Typically, the Illinois legislature meets for 2 weeks in November and December. It's called the fall veto session. And their primary objective is to deal with vetoes from the governor. Well, there aren't any vetoes from the governor this year. So I don't think there will be a typical fall veto session. I think if anything, the leaders will call what's referred to as a special session. And where if they do that, they have the ability to narrow the agenda to very specific issues. And I think ethics will be part of that special session. But again, it's all a wait and see approach. I will tell you that one of the strongest caucuses in the General Assembly is the Legislative Black Caucus. And given the tragedy of George Floyd and the healthcare disparities that became kind of apparent during COVID, along with the maternal crisis last year, we are expecting the Black Caucus to introduce an agenda containing a variety of social reforms that attempt to reduce a number of disparities, not just in healthcare, in education, in the economy, in any segment of society. But healthcare will be a main part of that. ISMS works extremely well with the Black Caucus. They are probably one of the more, they're almost conservative, and more than moderate. They do have a couple progressives, but they're very reasonable and very approachable. They will introduce stuff that we don't like, but we'll work through that and we'll get through it. But this will be a big issue for 2021. Again, we're gonna pursue prior authorization. We always anticipate fights on mandates. The one mandate that I didn't mention that was introduced, all too often legislators think they can mandate diseases away by telling you what you have to take as part of your CME. The Alzheimer's Association did introduce a mandate that would require a number of hours of your CME be dedicated to diagnosing and treating Alzheimer's. We did push back on this. It never got to the committee phase, but it's something we have to prepare for next year. The tricky wicket about mandates is you can't argue that they're well-intentioned. They just don't work. And that's something that, you know, we have to say up front. So that's another one we're watching out for sure. In kind of conclusion, you know, I often get questions from physicians on how can I help. You know, obviously joining ISMS is huge. You wouldn't have a legislative advocacy team if you didn't join the Med Society. There would be no Med Society. You know, there's various ways to get involved, and I'm happy to take questions on that. And then the most important thing to remember is politics are all local. And while we have what I like to hope is amazing relationships with legislators, nothing works better than the constituent, a physician calling their own legislator. Your stories, your personal stories about how things impact your ability to practice medicine are the most effective. And, you know, I'm here to help you do that. I'm more than happy to take questions on that. But that's really, really one of the most important things you can do. The other hat I wear, and I would be remiss if I didn't mention it, we have a political action committee. And so there's another way to get involved. We have to contribute and we have to help our friends. It's Illinois, we have to do it to be effective. And so if you haven't made a contribution to IMPACT, please consider doing so. You can go to impactonline.org. And make a contribution online, but it's extremely effective. Our fundraising efforts have been hampered, obviously due to COVID. We've suspended our fundraising efforts, but we're gearing up for the remap. So all of the in 2022, we're going to be running every single legislator will be up and running under a new map, and this is a fascinating time to really get engaged on that grassroots political effort. And that's really why we're reaching out now and urging physicians to contribute so we can be one of those main players in that time. So, you know, we have a whole website in case you don't have anything to do one day, and kind of gives you the brass tacks on, you know, how to get engaged. And it's kind of a fascinating read, but you know, that's what I'm here for too. And Mara has my contact information. And so you can always get a hold of me. My cell phone is always available and I'm happy to give that out. So with that, Mara, I think I'm gonna hand it back to you if I can figure this out. and so we can take questions. Oops. All right. Mara, how do I give you back the host? Pause. Sorry about this. Trying to make my. I can't find it, Mara. Okay, I think I got it. I apologize. Mark, can you unmute yourself? There. Oh. Okay. Sorry about that, guys. Mara, I think I just made you the host.
Okay, yeah, it looks like I'm back. Thank you so much, Erin. Appreciate it.
My talent is lobbying. My talent is not really stuff.
I couldn't unmute as long as you were host, but we're
so I apologize for that.
No, not at all. Okay. We can go through. I've got I see a hand already, so if we're ready to take questions. I've got John, Dr. Prunskis, I've got you. You have a question?
Sure. So, Erin, thanks very much for all the work you've done over the years and for a great presentation. Notwithstanding the technical glitches, I couldn't have done that either. So, congratulations.
I'm terrible
and,
at it.
And Mara, welcome.
Thank you.
I recognize most of the names here, but not all of them. So, very briefly, I'm Dr. John Prunskis. I'm medical director of the Illinois Pain Institute, and I'm a presidential appointee and co-author of the Health and Human Services Best Practices Pain Task Force, which has been endorsed by 100% of medical specialties, not 99%, 100% of every medical specialty society in the United States as the roadmap for the diagnosis and treatment of painful conditions. The reason I bring this up is whenever you are faced with either an educational need that ISMS puts on, or you're faced with a legislative hardship, the heavy lifting has been done. These guidelines, it was an honor to have served. I was the only physician selected from Illinois to serve on this commission. And it was way more work than I thought it would be. It took us a year to do it. But now every single medical specialty society has endorsed it. So when you are faced with a legislator, I think you said in Lake County or whatever county who wants to prescribe Narcan with narcotics, the work's already been done. That's not necessary. So just remember, whenever you are faced with any opioid, narcotic, or pain issue, feel free to refer to the Health and Human Services Best Practices Pain Task Report. And of course, feel free to contact me. And I just wanted to share that with not only you, Erin, and Mara, but anyone on this call. The heavy lifting has been done, and it's available for all. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Prunskis, and I will certainly do that. Mara, I'm getting some questions in the group chat. Should I read those?
Yeah, that would be good.
Okay. The first question is, will Michael Madigan be the head of the Democratic Party in Illinois for 1 year from today? Obviously, the question of Madigan is on everyone's mind. I am trying to figure out what the feds have, what the feds are going to do, what Mike Madigan might do. It's way above my pay grade. If I knew that, I'd write a book and sell, you know, make a couple million dollars. I will tell you that I don't think Madigan's going to go anywhere anytime soon. I think the feds are going to have a difficult time actually proving quid pro quo. That being said, there is pressure on him to resign. This is not Madigan's first rodeo, although this is a much more serious rodeo. I don't think in the near future he's going to go anywhere. That being said, I do think we are kind of at the precipice of the beginning of the end. I don't know how long that beginning is going to take, though. But we are going to see some change in leadership in the next 5 to 10 years. And I think 10 years is a stretch. But there will be some significant change in leadership in the upcoming years. It's not going to be in the next 2 years. Again, we have the legislative remap, and I'm confident Madigan wants to see that through. And I don't know that his caucus, there will be enough votes within his caucus to kick him out of speaker. And then the Democratic Party, you know, the state central committeemen, I think he's, while there's certainly some outspoken critics, I think he's got his support there. So I don't really have a great answer for you, other than we are going to see some change eventually. You know, I used to say that Madigan would outlive me. I no longer think that's the case. I do think we will see a next Speaker of the House in the next, you know, I'm going to say 5 to 7 years. Don't quote me on that, though, because if Madigan found out I said that, he'd be pissed, and it would really help my incentive. So that's just my thinking, but I could be totally wrong. The next question, Aaron, will you give us some thoughts on topics that should be priorities for us in conversations with our legislators? You know, again, our priority, and if you have stories to relate, is how do we reform prior authorization? I think the momentum is there. I think the legislators need to hear personal stories from physicians on how it has impacted care, because we know it does. And then when we talk about, you know, mandates, well, if we want to talk about the flip side, the bad stuff, you know, while not focusing on one mandate, you can focus on the frustration and maybe handicap is a good word. When the more mandates you have on you, the more you're handicapped from actually treating your individual patient as that individual patient needs to be treated. You know, the problem with mandates is they make all these assumptions that everybody's the same, that everybody needs the same treatment. That's not the case. But prior authorization is a real issue that I think we can get done. It's just going to take a lot of work, and it's going to take some grassroots efforts from physicians. So I hope that answers your question, okay? Again, if you haven't signed up for our alert system, you can do so on ISMS.org. And when an important piece of legislation, whether it's we're for it or against it, starts moving through the legislature, we send alerts out to all the physicians who signed up for this system, and we provide the contact information for your legislator, both your state senator and your state rep. And, you know, you can call them and say, ugh, I hear this is moving. This is why this is bad. Or, hey, this is a great bill. We would love your support on it. Again, you're the voter. They have to be responsive to you at the end of the day. So if you haven't done so, I would encourage you to sign up for that system as well. And then another question, please give us 3 to 5 short talking points that we can use to help us speak to prospective members and groups as we recruit them to ISMS. You know, it's hard to put into words, I think, on how great ISMS is. Again, as somebody who works for you, from the government, from the legislative advocacy side, I see what the opponents are doing. And what I like to tell physicians is I can't imagine where you guys would be if there wasn't an ISMS. You've got the trialers, you've got the insurance lobby, you know, you've got the scope of practice issues, and you've got legislators coming up with their own ideas on mandates. You know, a question, and this is not a criticism to the specialty societies at all. We worked very, very well with the specialty societies. But on the difficult issues, legislators call us. And without members, there is no us. And we are available 24/7. That's what we're here for, is to answer your questions and advocate for you. You know, I spent 6 months a year in the General Assembly in Springfield working with the General Assembly. And, you know, a lot of physicians don't know who I am. And that's because I'm talking more to legislators than anything else. And I think it's important. I hope physicians can realize how important that is, because legislators are always looking for ideas, and we want to give them the good ideas and convince them not to move with the bad ideas. So, you know, and we've got a whole membership department too that we can hook you up with, and we have a whole marketing plan that we can certainly hook you up with. This is just my personal, what I consider important. Okay, question about the pandemic. Nothing. So I don't know what I can say necessarily about the pandemic. All when it comes to referring to the pandemic, I can only tell you what the legislators are thinking. And they're scared. They're confused. They're scared for their constituents, and they don't know how to move forward. And again, this is why I think ISMS is so important. We want to be that guidance for them. I can't talk about the science or what's going on behind that. I can only talk about the legislative advocacy on the pandemic. And I can only tell you what the legislators are thinking and the questions they ask me. How do we get patients to join against the battle, join our battle against prior authorization? Again, I would highly encourage you guys to go to yourcarecan'twait.org. I think that's what it is. I might be a .com. I'll resend that information. So when we started this whole initiative late last year for the introduction in 2020, we had two meetings. One was with all the healthcare advocates, the hospital association, the allied professionals, behavioral health groups, to ask them to join the coalition. And then we met with all the patient advocacy groups to ask them to join the coalition. And everyone was enthusiastic about it. When we introduced our bill, the Arthritis Foundation actually provided us a name with an individual, a very young woman who suffers from a terrible arthritic condition, and the nightmare stories that she had just trying to get her monthly treatments shocked a lot of legislators. I think that, it depends on your comfort level, but it's incredibly important. I can't reach out to individual patients. I can only reach out to their groups. But if you're comfortable and you know your patients are frustrated, I would encourage them to go on this website and share their story. We have videos up there from patients, for instance, and it's we market it heavily to legislators. So that's kind of what we're doing on our end. And then, if you know people, patients who are frustrated from this, I would definitely encourage them to go to that site. I can help too. I'm certainly here to reach out. I'm more than happy to help. I think there's a question here, I'm just trying to get through all these. Is there a push to obtain the same reimbursement for telehealth services for rural health clinics as for regular office visits? I believe the answer is yes, but I will check up on that. We work very well with FQHCs and the rural healthcare group. So without me, I don't want to give the wrong answer, but I'll certainly follow up on that and get back to this group. The school question is tough. So here's a question: who's deciding when and how the children will be sent back to school? ISMS is not engaged in that. I think that this is an issue that the governor has left to the individual school districts. He has not passed down a state mandate. I think, and his Department of Education has said the same thing. I know in Chicago, for instance, they've been back and forth on part-time coming in or working remotely. I think we're going to see most school districts go back remotely. It's my understanding a lot of private schools are going to have their kids come back. But again, this is being made on an individual district level. This is not something that is being made on a statewide engagement level. How can we have an audience with the Black Caucus members as they discuss healthcare disparities and solutions with these issues? What is happening with the independent practice of MPs and PAs in Illinois? So we talk to the Black Caucus members every day. In fact, I've been setting up lunches with a series of them. I'm always happy to introduce physicians to members of the Black Caucus. It's always helpful if you live in their districts, But when bills come before the General Assembly, or if there's issues being debated and, you know, a physician wants to engage in this issue, I'm more than happy to set up that conversation with physicians and legislators. Again, they as individual members, they routinely reach out to us for our thoughts. There's always a couple legislators in any caucus that have their own ideas and has their own agenda. And we try to deal with them as best we can. But again, we do have a very excellent working relationship. And when those agendas, when we know what they're going to introduce, you will know, and we can proceed from there. What is happening with the independent practice? So physician assistants, they did introduce a bill. It didn't have any support. We were able to quash that pretty easily. You know, it's not always, it may not always be that way, but really there's not a lot of support in the legislature to grant them independent practice. You know, we did have a big fight with the APRNs years ago where we did increase their authority. They don't have complete independent practice. It was one of those issues. We were either going to lose it or we were going to negotiate. We did negotiate a bill that retained physician input and supervision in many cases. They have not come back with a bill to change that. I expect that will happen in the future, but I think the General Assembly's kind of worn out on that issue, and I don't expect that to change anytime soon. I could be wrong, but I don't think so. Telehealth in rural areas hampered by broadband. And it is hit and miss. It certainly is. The governor appropriated, I believe, $420 million. It could be more to institute his plan to provide statewide broadband. I do know the individual working on this. She's a good friend of mine. She's committed to this. She's actually from Southern Illinois, and her issue is to increase access to healthcare. So I do believe that this will stay a priority of the governor. He has a lot of work to do, but we will support him in those efforts for sure. Is there any conversation with state leaders about forming a coalition with other states to address COVID? For example, secure supply chain for testing or PPE. I think the governor has tried to do this. Again, this is something I have to follow up with. The fight for PPE was something that we engaged in that I didn't mention in my previous remarks. But man, that was a scramble. It was tough. I mean, I felt like states were fighting each other for PPE. We have a very good contact with the Illinois Manufacturers Association. So we were actually able to go around the state and secure PPE for some of our large clinics, and well, some of our small clinics as well. But that was that was one of the toughest fights I've seen. So I don't know what the governor's intentions are moving forward. I kind of feel like it's every state's on their own. I don't know. I could be wrong on that. But it's definitely something to watch. And if I get any more information on that, I'll be happy to follow up. You know, as far as the schools, I'm happy to go back and inquire with our leadership on how we might be able to influence. We have some very good contacts at the Department of Public Health as well. So you have my commitment that I will reach out to them and see, you know, what Dr. Ezeki is doing, what guidance she is providing, and see how we can be helpful there. It's just been a bit frustrating, because it is all left up to the individual districts. And I think this is where local physician groups could really have an impact. But you have my commitment. I will reach out to the Department of Public Health. See if they're talking to ISBE, the State Board of Education, and see if there's any guidance or however we can help. I think I've answered everybody's questions that put it in the chat. I apologize if I missed any, so.
I think you covered them all. I don't see any others in there.
We got one more. What specific events can we have to help us build relationships with our legislators? You know, I always tell physicians that the best way to meet a legislator is really to reach out to them when we're not in session and schedule a meeting in their district office just as an introductory meeting. You don't even have to have a specific topic you want to talk about, but just introduce yourself as a, you know, as a resource. So often, legislators they're not even looking to be lobbied. They're looking for information. And who do I turn to on this? And having that local physician that they know they can pick up the phone and call is so extremely helpful. So that's really what I recommend to physicians, rather than worrying about going to events and trying to make a connection. It's really take the time and then just introduce yourself. That will go so far, and you will find that you really realize that legislators are so appreciative of the fact that somebody took time out of their day to introduce themselves and say, you know, offer their expertise as a resource. And then this is it's to everyone. So I don't know if there's more questions, or thank you guys so much. If you don't have my cell phone, you know, Mara has it. If she doesn't, I'll certainly get it to her. Feel free to call me on my cell phone. I'm always available. That's what we're here for.
Any other comments or questions?
Okay, Aaron, thank you so much. It was nice getting to talk to you. Just as a quick follow-up, when are the legislatures not in session, just so we get an idea of?
That's a great question. So they start in January. They usually start mid-January, and session adjourns on May 31st. There's a constitutional hard stop to when our session adjourns. Okay. And then they're in 1 week in November and 1 week in December for veto session.
Okay. And actually, that was one of my questions, is how do I tangibly get to them? And I think the idea of even just showing up to introduce yourself as part of his constituency, mm-hmm. not necessarily with an agenda, I think is a great starting point.
Some legislators tend to forget it, but they're there for you. Yeah. I mean, you're their boss. You can vote them out, and they're there to serve you. And yeah. I would say, by and large, we have a General Assembly of legislators that do realize that. There's always, the couple that go on their own, but.
Okay, and would you happen to know if the ISMS website lists how everybody can find their state representative?
Yeah, it's under the Government Affairs Hub. We're kind of revamping it to make it easier to use, but there is a Find Your Legislator. We also have impactonline.org, which also provides that information. And you just plug in your address, and it will give you the contact information for both your state senator and your state rep, along with, I believe, your congressman.
Okay, excellent. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. And since we are kind of at a little over our hour mark, I think this was excellent. Thank you for those great tips. And we'll look forward to maybe one day seeing you in person again.
Yes, I hope so.
And
we'd like to thank
everybody for joining. And we'll see everybody at some events when we're in person again.
Take care.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you. Have a good night.